So one of the large focuses of my lab here is to focus on how we can create genderless robot at homes doing chores for you that you don't want to do. This could be like, for example, cleaning up your messy kitchen or doing your laundry and ironing them and putting clothes back.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Join host Sanjay Puri as he explores the dynamic and developing world of artificial intelligence governance. Each episode features deep dives with global leaders at the forefront of regulating AI responsibly, tackling the challenges using AI can bring about head-on and enabling balance without hindering innovation.
Welcome to the Regulating AI podcast. Artificial intelligence, AI, stands at the forefront of technological evolution, with experts predicting that it could add trillions of dollars to our GDP, but it could also negatively impact our workforce and national security. So how do we regulate it without stifling innovation? Our podcast features insights from various perspectives. We've had industry leaders, CEOs, to government officials, members of Congress, to leaders of advocacy and civil rights groups, and academics. Together, they address pivotal questions that are needed to create practical legislation for such a transformative technology. I'm very excited to have Professor Dr. Abhinav Vallada with us today. He heads the Robot Learning Lab at the University of Freiburg. I invited him on this show as it is very important to get different perspectives towards framing legislation for this transformative technology. And we need to get the perspective of robotics experts. Welcome, Abhinav. It's an absolute pleasure to have you on the Regulating AI podcast.
Thanks for having me, Sanjay. Great to be here.
Wonderful. Abhinav, for our listeners, can you give them a little bit of your background and the work that you're currently doing at the university?
Yeah, sure. So I lead the Robot Learning Lab in Freiburg in Germany. And we basically work on what's called robot learning. So how do you develop robotic systems that can learn from the world around us so that they can generalize to different applications without the need for hand engineering robots that's mostly done today? And the applications are very diverse, from self-driving cars to assistive robots at homes doing potentially chores for you in the future. We go from the wide spectrum of transportation to assistance, medical robots as well, logistics, and so on.
Wow. Abhinav, we had a ChatGPT moment in AI, large language models. People, at least in the robotics community, say, especially what some of the things that Google has been showing, and I would love to get your perspective, is that maybe in the next year or two, robotics is going to have a ChatGPT-like moment. What are your thoughts on that? Where, in the sense, it's going to be something, you know, we had AI for a long time, but it just came into the mind share of people just now. It's AI is everywhere. Every resume is AI, every company is AI. Do you think robotics has the potential to have something to get into the minds of mainstream right now?
Great question. I think two parts to this question, right? Like, one, all the boom that's generally going on with AI and what people, I think, perceive AI can do today and what AI can actually do today. And then there's also this aspect of how does this translate to robotics? So I'll try to answer the first question first. And I think it's no denying that we've gone leaps and bounds over the last decade on what anyone might have even imagined that's possible with AI. But I think it has its own limitations. And as a roboticist and as a AI academic person, I wouldn't even call the AI that we have actually intelligent. So it's really good at generating data and doing some task that it knows, but I wouldn't call it true intelligence as what we would perceive. And I think that's one aspect of it. And the other part of how this translates to robotics is some things translate very directly in terms of robots perceiving the environment. That's like the first step that robots need to do when you deploy them around the world. But there's a lot more to robotics because robots physically need to interact with the world. And although we have gone quite far, I think, in the last few years on what we can enable robots to physically learn by interacting with the world. It's not remotely as much as where we have gone with other things like ChatGPT or generative AI in terms of vision, like DALL-E and so on. So I think we still need to go a lot more far. And one of the bottlenecks that, if you ask me, would be that things like ChatGPT or any of the vision domain models, you can train them on internet data, which is just available, right? But it's really not possible to train a robot on internet data because it needs to know physics, needs to learn about how to do these tasks in the real world. And it's not really possible to put every robot in every location in the world to just make them learn around them. This would be chaotic. And even if it's possible, we don't even have the mechanisms to make them learn. I guess the first the step here is, how do we leverage the advances that we have made over learning from unstructured data that's freely available on the internet and translate this to robotics? And I think that's the biggest challenge that a lot of people are working on in robotics. As you mentioned, Google as well, and we also had a collaboration with them in December over creating this really large data set that's called the embodiment data set and embodiment X data set. And this is the first step in this direction, or having robots in all over the world collect data doing very diverse tasks. And this is as big as, for example, the ImageNet data set that really sparked it off. So now that we have the data set, so I guess the next step is, how do we create methods that leverage this data set to create the generalist robot that's able to learn from this diverse data?
Okay. For our audience who might not be robotics experts, I am going to try to parse it down a little bit. Yeah. What you're saying is there are some constraints, unlike with large language models, which can take unstructured data from the net. Robots obviously need to know about physics and other stuff. And you, from learning from each other, you would need to have tens and thousands of millions of these robots. So that's a constraint. Do you see, just as a follow-on, and this is the integration of, let's say, large language models, or now large language models have multimodal capability as the vision, text, etc. And then we are now talking about super agents. It depends on who you talk to, getting closer to AGI. Is there any kind of integration? This is the geek in me who wants to know, of either super agents with robots or ultimate AGI with robots. Is that any possibility of that happening?
Great question. So I think what large language models have sparked, we also use a lot the capability of LLMs today in robotics. And what we use them for is basically reasoning, or trying to reason. So what's great with large language model is, because it's trained on human language data, there's lots of reasoning that goes into how we structure our sentences and what this means. And this is a great resource to exploit for teaching or for communicating with the robot what tasks that needs to accomplish. But there's a lot more to it, because what LLMs do, or large language models do, are they're basically generative models that generate new language data based on what you have trained it on. So in many situations, if you ask them things that are basically things that you would say a five-year-old child would be able to reason logically, they would not be able to do that. And this is because they're not built essentially to reason in terms of logic, but they're more in terms of how we structure our language and talk to each other with the language. There's certain things that we can do with LLMs that, again, are really helpful in terms of communicating what we want the robots to do in terms of task descriptions. But if we want the robot to reason in situations, what is right or wrong, or how do I do this, or how do I do that in a given situation, they do not really translate that today. And again, this is a very open research question to tackle. And there's some work that's going on in terms of large language models. As you mentioned before, we already have vision language models, which are large language models with generative vision models. And then the obvious next step is to have large language models with vision, with action. And these are called vision language action models. That's the biggest step that would, that we need to basically take to know that if AGI is even possible in the real world, where so-called artificial agents have to take actions, perceive the world and take actions.
Abhinav, with the tremendous advancements in compute, learning the GPUs, et cetera, and obviously with deep learning and neural networks, your work obviously has advanced, should have advanced quite a bit over this period of time, right?
Yeah, definitely. Compute is one of the largest reasons, biggest reasons, I think, that has enabled us to do all the things that we do today. A lot of the principles and the techniques that we use today, we knew them before. It's just that we couldn't realize them with the compute capability that we had before. And definitely, GPUs have played a tremendous role in realizing and advancing this capability. And one different aspect or unique aspect when it comes to robotics is that what you can do with other learning systems is not really possible, because it's not possible to put an enormous amount of GPU compute on a physical robot. What you could possibly do is this learning on the cloud, for example, where you could have a lot of resources on the cloud and just be able to communicate with the cloud with your internet. And that works really well. But we also have other constraints that we still need to be able to do this efficiently, because you need to be able to deploy them on very embedded GPUs on the robot. And that's, again, a new challenge that has to be tackled, that many of us are still working on.
You talked at the beginning about the kind of work that you're doing. Robot emotions also is a very important area that a lot of people are working on. Is that something that you're working on, Abhinav?
Not specifically emotions. I think what we try to do in many of our work is to convey intent, is what I would call it. Because if you want robots to work collaboratively alongside humans, you definitely need to convey intent to humans about what the robot is trying to do. Also assess intent of people, what the people are trying to do. So I wouldn't call it per se emotions is what we work on, but more about how to live and act with humans in a collaborative manner. And for this, it's also a matter of safety, if you think about it. And this could be even in the domain that, for example, autonomous cars. So there's a lot of behavior changing on if you follow the human rules that an autonomous car would follow on the road. So now if a human knows that it's an autonomous car, they wouldn't behave the same way to the car as they would to a person. So there's a lot of complex dynamics going on there. So there's lots of intent that robots, I think, need to convey to people what they're capable of, what they're going to do, and also assess the intent of people. And that's the focus that we specifically do in our work, but not so much the emotions aspect of it.
How about human-robot interaction? Are you doing much in terms of that?
Yeah, definitely. So one of the large focuses of my lab here is to focus on how we can create genderless robots at homes doing chores for you that you don't want to do. This could be like, for example, cleaning up your messy kitchen, or doing your laundry and ironing them and putting clothes back. So there are situations here where you want robots to collaborate with humans to do a task together. And we try to tackle these everyday tasks where we want to do them at home, at our homes. And one of the challenges that you bring up in human-robot interaction scenario, definitely, if there is AI or any learning in the robot that's going into this, the critical aspect that you also need to account for is what are the risks that a robot need to assess while interacting with a human. And this is also a very, very emerging field, which is also going into products and basically these compliant laws, many of the ISO standards that are coming up have certain factors where you need to be able to assess risks that come in. So if there is, for example, a robot going to hand you some object in your hand, what is the risk that it bumps into your hand, for example? So I think this risk assessment is a really big thing that's coming up, not only from standardization, but also legislation. And this also pushes us technologists to find ways where we can do this, because I think right now there's not very direct and easy ways to even do this technologically.
What about privacy issue and user right issues when we are doing this human right, human robot interaction? How are you safeguarding for that?
Great question. I think there's many ways. So we have a learning framework that inherently has privacy incorporated into this, which is called federated learning, used a lot in our banking system, or also a lot in hospitals where you need to transfer data to some other location to do learning. So what this does is that your data stays remotely on the machine that's close to you, but rather only sends, let's say, abstracted information that's extracted from this data to the learning algorithm to do stuff, to learn on top of this. So this is one layer of privacy-preserving ability that we have into our learning mechanisms. But there's lots of research going on in this direction as well. So I think in the last few years, what people have also shown is that it's really possible with these generative methods, even if you abstract away this information, to then regenerate or recreate this information again. So what we do specifically doesn't really involve products. So we deal with public data sets, so we don't have this concern. But of course, in some areas that we are working on, for example, in the medical domain, where we want robots to be, for example, doing surgeries completely autonomously in the future, we need to collect data. For this, we are working together with regulators, medical professionals, trying to come up with frameworks where we can still collect data in these scenarios, protecting the privacy of the people involved and to be still using the data for training methods for robots to do.
No, that's very helpful. In terms of ethical guidelines and public consultation, what mechanism should be established, in your view, to ensure that there is compliance with ethical standards and the development and operation of these systems?
I think, first of all, it's very important to create guidelines which basically fit the reality of the robotic systems that we have. One challenge that I feel we have is that most of the guidelines that exist today to regulate robots or AI are too general, and it's not very clear how you can apply them to many of the things that we do with robotic systems or even AI today. And I get the reason why they are formulated very broad, but if you give any of these guidelines to people who develop technology, I think it's still quite hard for them to realize how do you incorporate them into this technology development process. And for this, I think it's really important to have interdisciplinary teams that basically formulate these guidelines. And I don't think it stops with formulating the guidelines, because I think this is an iterative process where you need to, again, adapt these guidelines to specific settings or applications that you have. Otherwise, I think these very broad guidelines are really hard to incorporate into our technology development process. But I think definitely the first step is to formulate a broad guideline and then continue to iterate this along with developers, policymakers, and so on to adapt to the task at hand.
As you said, you need to have these broad guidelines. Do you think there should be independent ethics review boards to review some of these ethical implications of the applications of robotics and unmanned technologies, Abhinav?
Yeah, definitely. If you ask me, it depends on which level. So if you're talking about products, I would definitely agree that the same way that we have technology assessment that we have to do before developing a product, I think in these cases, it's very important to analyze the benefits and the drawbacks and the cases that it works in every possible scenario. But if you consider research, I would personally say that this would inhibit progress than to promote it. So that being said, I would definitely say that something like ethical teaching about AI ethics should be incorporated into every curriculum as early as possible, so that this becomes a way of thinking while we are teaching the next generation of researchers. But definitely, I would say that having this as a very stringent requirement while doing research, I feel, would inhibit progress a little.
So it would inhibit progress, but what you're saying is there should be some kind of ethics training. So let's say, should there be a requirement that, let's just say, the developers that are working for you, there should be some kind of an ethics training for people who are working on robotics and unmanned systems, even at an educational level, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Now, in Germany, it's even become a requirement from this year, last year. If you have a program on AI that you're teaching, for example, a master's in AI, you're supposed to have an ethics course on AI that's incorporated. I think this is a really great first step to teach people who develop technology of the future what they should keep in mind. And I think this should continue throughout the careers, in the sense that I don't think this should stop at the level of universities, but I think it would also be interesting and imperative to have this kind of training also at the level of engineering developers at companies, for example.
You're saying is it should not just, you know, stop at the university level, it should continue. So do you think we should have some ethical auditing, that we can have some kind of a system to audit the ethics in the robotic and unmanned system throughout their life cycles to make sure they are adhering to this ethical standards that we are looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is very important value, especially when you're developing a product. I don't think this is something that we should be doing only at the end stage after you have it developed, but rather evaluate this iteratively throughout the cycle of development. And in my point of view, that's the only way to assess essentially if we are going to conform to these requirements.
I've been switching a little bit in terms of from ethics to human rights, and we'll come back to ethics. Is, do you think there is a human right impact on the deployment of some robotics and unmanned systems?
Absolutely. I think this is a very large ongoing discussion, I think, in the community currently and also in the last couple of years. I think this is really important to maintain our human rights while using autonomous systems. And in many cases, we have seen that this is not the case, especially when you have autonomous systems. This sort of, I feel, leaves away some of the human rights that we would otherwise adhere to, while if we have them as machines, for example, operated by humans. And I think this is definitely a big thing, that we should have regulation to ensure that these human rights are also maintained while using or deploying autonomous systems to do any tasks that you have.
Robotics and unmanned systems are now being used in surveillance also. How can we make sure that our privacy and ethical principles are safeguarded when some implementation of some of these things happen?
We have a set of ethical requirements or regulations, and one of them could be, for example, like transparency about what the system can do and what the system uses the data to do. But definitely all of this should be done with a layer of privacy protection, as well as human oversight and control to be able to decide what this data is to be used. And I also think that definitely this should conform with, in high-risk applications, this should definitely conform with very, very stringent regulations that should come with it. And yeah.
shifting a little bit to workforce, as there's a big fear AI is going to take jobs, and there have been all kinds of reports, especially with LLMs, ChatGPT, the numbers are 40-60%. And those are mainly white-collar jobs. But when you look, think about robotics, especially in manufacturing, what are your thoughts in terms of workforce displacement, massive workforce displacement that could happen? And how does one deal with that, Abhinav?
I think what we would immediately see before this future that you imagine that only robots would be doing most of the jobs is, I think first there would be robots doing jobs with you, and they would help you do your jobs better and make your life easier. I think that's the first goal that we would see in the next decade or so. And I don't think this massive displacement is going to happen anytime soon. And that being said, this it might displace some jobs that, for example, are that we call in robotics dull, dirty, and dangerous jobs. And this is a good thing because then we can use the human workforce in areas where you don't necessarily want to do these jobs. And especially in situations that are very dangerous to humans, for example, in disaster, in search and rescue, in nuclear power plants. And in these situations, when you want to keep humans away because they are more dangerous to them, we will see more autonomous systems potentially working in these scenarios. But I personally don't think that anytime soon in the near future, we would have really large displacement of workforce, and we would see more collaborative work with autonomous systems in the near future.
Let's talk about international collaboration. As you can see, there's the EU AI Act. The US is working on its own AI legislation. China is doing its own thing. But besides regulation, legislation, standards on safety for robotics and legislation, do you think it's important to have international collaboration towards that?
Yeah, absolutely. I think international collaboration is very imperative. As you already mentioned, we have on the artificial intelligence laws of China, the EU and the US are very different. Many of them talk about aspects of different, for example, many of them talk about aspects that are very broad and some of them are very specific. So in this case, for example, if there was more international collaboration while drafting these laws, if one or the other agencies have already come up with ways to make these laws, these regulations more specific, this could easily translate to our other international counterparts if there was more engagement instead of reinventing the whole wheel again. So I think this is something that international bodies should definitely come together to discuss and draft. And what we have currently is only the first step. So I'm quite confident that the next step would be syncing with agencies across different continents. And we will definitely see more international collaboration because I think that's the only way progressively going forward.
So obviously, to summarize, you're saying international collaboration is very important and you think that's going to happen and that's the only way going forward. Abhinav, how does your organization, institution, your academic institution approach inclusion of diverse voices and perspectives in your R&D towards robotics? Because that's also important to make sure that there are many different perspectives and diverse voices that are there.
Absolutely. So we actually have a lot of interdisciplinary collaboration. We collaborate a lot with our experts in law, the professors in law, professors in social science, ethics. We have many projects where we have a large interdisciplinary team that's interdisciplinary, not only in terms of their expertise or the fields that they work on, but also in terms of the diversity of where they come from and also the gender. And I think all of this plays a very important role in ensuring that all aspects of diversity are equally addressed in the research that we are doing. And the first step to that is, I feel, having this interdisciplinary group where we can collaborate together in solving tasks.
So you have a strong interdisciplinary group to make sure, like you said, the legal and other areas. That's great to know. Abhinav, in the event of some ethical lapses or some accidents, do you think, and who should be held responsible for the design, operation, and use of robotic and unmanned systems?
Personally, I feel this, like any other product, we would hold a company who's developing the product responsible. And I feel that should be the same in this case. And only then would the companies that would develop this incorporate these stringent evaluation cycles also in terms of ethical regulations into their products. So I think this should be the responsibility of the people or the company that develops products that are going to be deployed in the world.
Abhinav, can you tell us in terms of any specific programs or initiatives that you might have developed that gives access to diversity, inclusion, especially in terms of robotics and AI, and how do you feel that you're addressing some of the social equities? Because robotics is an expensive area, just like AI is. How do you think that can lead to benefiting diverse communities and also engaging all kinds of people in terms of these areas?
So one example could be, we have many research funding schemes, for example, in Germany, where they are specifically meant to address high technology projects, which essentially require the expertise of engineers, lawmakers, social scientists, artists, and so on. So one such project that we have, that we were very fortunate to get, that goes on for 7 years here, is this setting where we want to develop the next generation of robots that are going to help us to do everyday chores in the home. And here, what we have incorporated is every year we do, but actually more than once a year, we do these workshops with the public, to show what's possible with technology that we're developing today, and also to get feedback from the public of how they feel that this would be used in their daily lives in the future. And we incorporate this while doing research throughout the cycle. So such bi-directional exchange that we have got so far, I think has been extremely useful while developing this technology and researching more about this technology. And this could be a great way if we could implement this across the scale about doing participatory research while developing high technology areas such as this to involve more the needs of the diverse people around us.
Just to follow through on that question, how does your institution approach the education and training of future roboticists and AI researchers from diverse backgrounds? And what strategies are you employing to make sure there is inclusivity within these programs?
So we have diverse ways. So one of the ways is we have specific scholarships for underrepresented groups. And we try to promote these scholarships as much as we can. And these scholarships, for example, give people from underrepresented groups enough funding for them for their entire master's, for example, master's studies. And what we've seen is that this has been a great way for people who potentially wouldn't be able to come to a country like Germany, where they also need to pay for their own living expenses. So this enables them to study, for example, focus on the study and do research without having to do simultaneously another job to enable them to study. So this is like one way I think that these scholarships could bring diverse people. But I also think that this is something that we need to address not only at the level of university, but going even deeper at the level of schools. So only if we have these programs that let our very young students know that they have these opportunities where it's also open to them, that they will be willing to take the step. So we also take part a lot in university fairs that are, for example, held all over the world. And we try to let the next generation of students know what opportunities are available to them.
Oh, that's very helpful. So you're very proactive on these activities. Abhinav, you talked about self-driving cars. That's one of the areas of research for you. So as they continue to develop, as we've had Waymo, we have Tesla, we have Cruise. Now Cruise obviously is disbanded. What, and because they had this accident where there was a passenger who was driven across and that kind of led to a huge issue. But what regulatory measures do you think are essential to address safety issues relating to self-driving cars?
Yeah, I consider definitely regulatory measures are very important in the transportation or the self-driving car domain. And one way is essentially what many of the companies already do is to have these pilot programs where you deploy these autonomous vehicles to test in the environments rather than just controlled environments that they do while development. Of course, in order to do that, you already need to be certain technology level ahead. On the other hand, we over the years, I feel we've also improved our safety standards and certifications that we need to do before we can have a vehicle operating safely in our environment. And definitely what will improve this even further is data collection and sharing regulations as we deploy these systems. The more that we have these systems deployed in our natural environment, more that we can get data about situations where they don't function well. And only by realizing these situations, we would be able to correct them. Because as much as testing that you could do in controlled environments, I don't think it's possible to predict every possible scenario in the world when these systems are going to be unconstrained. So the only way is to deploy them in pilot programs and to ensure that, for example, there's a safety driver in case things don't work as expected, and collect data and to analyze this data and make sure that these situations don't happen. So another thing that's also coming up a lot is this vehicle-to-vehicle and vehicle-to-infrastructure communication. So this is another way where you can have another layer of safety into this. For example, if you have traffic infrastructure where it's noticing that your vehicles are not behaving as they are supposed to behave, or in situations where people around them may not behave how they are expected to behave around an autonomous car. So in these situations, for example, a remote operator could take over in order to prevent unforeseen circumstances. So I think these are some of the ways that we can definitely improve this going forward. And definitely public awareness is something that we need to improve on. I think there's lots of expectations about driving vehicles. So public awareness about what they are possible, education campaigns about the limitations and the safety implications are something that we really need to take a big step forward.
As you said, more data as we collect that. Second is obviously public awareness that you talked about. And you also said some interesting things like the V2V, vehicle-to-vehicle technology, and V2I, vehicle-to-infrastructure technologies that would really make a big difference, because we have 100,000 people that die in physical accidents and we just accept that. And then obviously with the self-driving vehicles, we have this issue. I understand that. Again, you don't have a crystal ball. When do you see level 5 autonomy happening? Do you see that anytime soon? And level 5, you might want to just let our viewers understand, level 5 is full-scale autonomy, which we don't have. Now, some people claim we have, but we don't have, so to speak.
So if you talk about every possible scenario in the world, I think this is a really hard challenge. Because if you imagine, you also have scenarios where it's really difficult to model the environment, how advanced systems that you may have, for example, in unconstrained scenarios where there are traffic rules essentially don't exist. For example, in outback environments or several other scenarios where there are a billion people on the road. So these are very difficult challenges which we haven't even started thinking of addressing. So I think that there is quite a bit ways to go to achieve true level 5, but I don't think this is bad. We need to work towards it to achieve it.
Yeah. And I think for people like me who don't know how to parallel park, at least getting that has been a big help. So I have no arguments towards that. We know this has been fantastic conversation to have you on there. Our audience, as I said, is made up of lawmakers, think tanks, CEOs, AI experts, and other aficionados around the world. As an expert roboticist, any message for them as they grapple in terms of this transformative technology, putting some guardrails, regulations around them?
I think the key is to work together. I think there's no, as you mentioned, there's no magic golden key that's going to solve everything. And I think this is something that we definitely need to do, and we should come together to do with people with diverse background as possible.
Great. Those are great points. Work together with many different and diverse voices. And we continue. That's what this podcast is. We bring in roboticists. We bring in health policy experts. We bring in drone experts, civil rights organizations, lawmakers, etc. But thank you so much for taking the time. It was very informative. I'm sure our audience learned a lot. I learned a lot. And hopefully we'll have you back again, because there's so much more that I wanted to ask. So thank you again, Abhinav.
Thanks a lot for having me, Sanjay.
Thanks for tuning in to the Regulating AI Innovate Responsibly podcast. You'll find links in the show notes to any resources mentioned on the show. If you're enjoying our podcast, please subscribe so you'll never miss an episode, and leave us a 5-star review.